This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 7th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be asking whether Afghan President Hamid Karzai is sacrificing women's rights to improve relations with the Taliban. We'll also be checking in with Monocle's fashion editor, Takaharu Sato, to hear what's caught his eye on the catwalks of Paris. And Wednesday means culture, so we'll be hearing from Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, who's in Geneva. Plus, I'll be joined live in the studio by the author, Robert Levine, to discuss whether government attempts to stop online piracy are really working. And is the Armory Show now the hottest ticket in New York City? We'll ask art expert Lisa Schiff. All that plus some great music as well, right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. So let's get the news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, has accompanied the Syrian Arab Red Crescent into the Homs district of Babu Amr. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent aid convoy found that most residents of the district, where rebels resisted bombardment by government forces for several weeks, had fled. It entered Babu Amr soon after Amos had held talks in the Syrian capital, Damascus. The UN Arab League Special Envoy to Syria, Kofi Annan, will travel to Damascus on March the 10th for what will be his first visit since being appointed to the post. Speaking earlier on the briefing on Monocle 24, Richard Gowan from the Centre for International Cooperation said Mr. Annan's visit was vital.
He may be the only man who can bring everyone together around a deal. That said, the chances against a deal are still very high. The situation in Syria is not promising.
Lebanon's former prime minister called the Syrian government a murderer and likened his crackdown on an 11-month revolt to Israeli wars on Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. Six British soldiers have been killed after their armoured vehicle was hit by an explosion while they were on patrol in Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. The incident marked the biggest single loss of life for British troops in Afghanistan since 2006. The British Prime Minister David Cameron expressed his sympathies to the families of those killed.
Well, this is a desperately sad day for our country and desperately sad, of course, for the families concerned. It is a reminder of the huge price that we're paying for the work we're doing in Afghanistan, the sacrifice that our troops have made and continue to make.
In the US presidential Republican primaries, Mitt Romney secured a close victory in Ohio but failed to land a knockout blow against rival Rick Santorum on Super Tuesday, raising the odds of a drawn-out battle for the Republican presidential nomination between the party's establishment and its grassroots conservatives. Romney won 5 of the 10 state contests, but his margin of victory was uncomfortably slim in Ohio, the night's biggest prize. And as Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield says, there's no reason for Santorum to give up yet.
He won 3 states. He ran Romney very close in Ohio. When you look at some of those states coming up soon, he's to win one of those. If Gingrich perhaps drops out, that, oddly, is perhaps the best result of the night for Romney.
The Norwegian anti-Islam militant Anders Behring Breivik was charged today with terrorism and the premeditated murder of 77 people. A trial is due to start next month. Prosecutors said they would seek a sentence of psychiatric care for the killer, but might demand 21 years in prison if an initial diagnosis of psychosis is contradicted by a second opinion.
If this conclusion is accepted by the court, then Breivik will be transferred to psychiatric ward and not prison.
Breivik has admitted carrying out a bomb attack last July that killed 8 people at government headquarters in Oslo and a gun massacre hours later that killed 69 people at a Labour Party summer camp. And as the Arab Spring continues to change the landscape of the Middle East and North Africa, the tourist industries in these countries have seen a significant downturn. In an attempt to give them a boost, Arab countries were the main focus at the international travel trade show ITB, which opened in the German capital Berlin today. Countries ranging from Egypt and Qatar to Tunisia and Morocco are showcasing their traditional clothing, jewellery and music at the event, which is being attended by more than 10,000 exhibitors from 187 countries. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nick. Looking at the front pages of the Australian and the New Zealand press today, much about the Skype affair and excuse me, and the reappointment of the Commodore who was suspended with the so-called Skype affair last year. Stephen Smith has been forced to reappoint Commodore Bruce Kafer, and he was suspended after a woman alleged that she was filmed during sex and it was broadcast on Skype. Stephen Smith publicly criticised the Commodore's actions, but a report now into the service now points to many failings and says that a trial for the Commodore would be inappropriate and there needs to be a wider look at the services themselves. Looking to the age of Australia, there's an economic story about the differing growth levels across Australia and how Victoria is slipping behind. It's on the brink of recession, according to The Age, while South Australia, Tasmania are already in the grips of one. Growth to the end of December for the last 3 months of last year were just 0.4% on average. Virtually all of the growth that Australia has now seen have been in Western Australia, Queensland and New South Wales. And The Age goes on to say that if current growth rates are maintained in 2 years, Queensland will overtake Victoria on the key economic measure of final demand. Looking at the New Zealand press and the press itself, has a rather large picture of picketers at Lyttelton Port, where the port itself, the Port Authority, has been granted the right to force workers, maritime workers, to unload a ship which had been left in the water, the Lisa Schult. They've been forced to unload this blacklisted ship. The workers had demanded better terms. It's the third such row over ships and the third such ruling that the workers must unload the ship. And looking at the New Zealand Herald as well, the child sex offender hired as a teacher. This story refers to a teacher who pleaded guilty to 8 charges of assault on a 15-year-old girl in the early 90s. And the board of trustees, the education authorities, and the principal at this school that he was subsequently hired at all knew of this conviction. Parents in uproar. The school principal remaining defiant. He's turned around and done everything right, says the school principal. But the victim's mother says, I have no reason to trust him with anyone else's daughters. There's also a lovely picture of Daisy's cash flow crisis. This is the story of toddler Daisy Radley, who ate some money. And she had a lucky escape there. They obtained the coin back without any damage to her body. I think it's time to go to the weather now with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And the weather is very changeable across Europe at the moment. Weather fronts are crossing the continent daily and most western and central countries are getting a mix of sunshine and rain. The Alps are in for a fresh covering of snow, about 10 to 20 centimetres over the next 24 hours in many of the resorts. Towards the end of the week, however, warmer and sunnier weather is heading to Europe. Spring is set to return to many parts of the continent, in fact. Here's Thursday's City Outlook in the meantime. London, 10 degrees, some sunshine. Zurich, 5 degrees and rain. Vienna, also 5 with a wet day here. And in Budapest, 3 degrees and partly cloudy. How about North America? Wednesday and Thursday, good weather across the east of the US from Florida up to DC and New England. At the same time, though, storms will start to develop across the deep south of the US again. It looks like the end of the week will bring severe weather to many places like Texas, Arkansas, and Kentucky. Again, a risk of tornadoes. Thursday's City Outlook, Washington, D.C., warm and sunny, 20 degrees here. Chicago, 7 degrees and rain. Dallas, 22, chance of thunderstorms here. And in L.A., it's 23 and sunny. And a look at some other world locations. Oh, great weather across northern China at the moment. In Beijing, sunny skies for the rest of the week. It's about 6 degrees here, but below zero at night. In Seoul, chilly as well, partly cloudy. In Sapporo, Japan, about 2 degrees with a few snow flurries. And that's all I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernecker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomash. It's 9 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now, the war in Afghanistan has often been justified by referencing the impact it's had on women's lives in the country. Girls now attend school, women can vote, and there are female MPs sitting in the Afghan parliament. Before 2001, when the nation was ruled by the Taliban, women were effectively under house arrest. Those who held respectable jobs in the early to mid-90s were stripped of their roles and reduced to begging on the street. The installment of President Karzai in 2001 hailed a new era for Afghanistan. Afghanistan, or at least a return to the pre-Taliban days. But Mr. Karzai sparked concern now by backing a new code of conduct put forward by clerics at the Ulema Council, which campaigners claim is a giant step backwards for women's rights in the country. I'm joined on the line now from Kabul by Heather Barr, an Afghan researcher for Human Rights Watch. Thank you for joining me, Heather. I guess the first question should be what this new code advises. What are the main points of this code of conduct?
Well, the first thing I should say is that it's not all bad news. The code, it does include some good provisions. It talks about the right that women have to property and to inheritance. It speaks out against forced marriage, which has been a really critical issue in Afghanistan. And it also says that, you know, it talks about the rights of women under Islam and says that women shouldn't be given to resolve disputes, which has also been an abusive practice that's happened here in the past. However, it also contains a lot of provisions that are worrying. It talks about women being secondary to men. It says that women should not be allowed to travel without a male chaperone, which obviously would create some serious freedom of movement issues. And it says that women should not mix with men while engaging in education or employment or even in public spaces. So in many ways, these provisions are harking back to some of the restrictions that women endured under the Taliban.
So in many ways, it's a mixed bag. There are some empowering points, but some may be restrictive, and it cements those perceptions about the regime there and its view on women as second rate. Surely, though, Karzai has to reach a sort of compromise. There are differing views in Afghanistan, and he's been accused in the past of representing purely Western values. If he's to unite the country, he has to represent and compromise in ways. And this is the belief of many people in Afghanistan.
Well, it's certainly true that Karzai has a difficult line to walk. But I think that what's really frightened people so much about this particular statement is the timing of it and the fact that it comes at a moment when we've just seen these agreements to set up an office for the Taliban in Qatar. There's a lot of pressure on Karzai and on his international allies to try to reach a negotiated agreement with the Taliban. And women have been afraid as long as this effort has been going on to talk about negotiations that one of the first things that could be negotiated away is the rights of women. So I think that a lot of people are seeing Karzai's support for this statement by the Ulema Council as being perhaps the beginning of that actually happening.
Is it more than political positioning rather than having a social impact on the country?
Well, it's more than political positioning. I mean, it could have a real consequence on women's lives. I mean, it's very unclear what a negotiated settlement with the Taliban might look like, and people are speculating about a lot of different scenarios, including the Taliban having de facto control over part of the country, including the constitution of Afghanistan, which actually says that men and women have equal rights, being revised into a more Taliban-friendly constitution that, for example, might take out that guarantee of equal rights.
The level of support seen for the Taliban in some sections of society in Afghanistan makes it more likely that Karzai has to reach out and not a power-sharing deal, but certainly negotiate and share some element of the policymaking for the country.
Well, it is quite difficult to know how much people do or don't support the Taliban. I think sometimes what looks like support for the Taliban is more actually fatigue with living in a conflict zone. And I think that, you know, Afghans don't appreciate having foreign troops in their country. They don't appreciate living in areas where their children can't go to school or it's not safe to go to the market because there's fighting going on all the time. So I think it would be a mistake to think that the fact that people are tired of fighting means that they are embracing the Taliban's cultural values. I think that most Afghans want their daughters to go to school and see value in women having the opportunity to work.
Are we likely, though, to see a clawback to the days of the Taliban in power and the levels of the disparity between rights for men and women that we saw back then before 2001? Or with Karzai in charge still, we're not likely to go back to that point, are we?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the Taliban is actually controlling large parts of the country right now. And I think in those Taliban-controlled areas, there's probably not a whole lot of difference between how life was in early 2001 and how it is now for women. So, you know, if we're talking about those parts of the country, then that doesn't have that much to do with Karzai unless there's a change in the status quo. In terms of the parts of the country that are controlled by the government, I think that Karzai hasn't done as much as he could have done to try to enforce some of the rights that have been written into the law since 2001 to protect women.
And looking at the international community and its views on his perhaps inaction and enforcing these rights in the past, and now this latest move of endorsing this code of conduct, it's not likely to make him popular in the Western world, is it?
Well, no, it's not, but I think the question that Afghan women's rights activists are really asking is does the West care anymore, or has the West gotten tired of Afghanistan and decided to give up, even if that includes giving up on Afghan women?
Heather, I must leave it there. Heather Barr from Human Rights Watch, thank you for that. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be hearing what's caught the eye of Monocle's Takaharu Sato at the Paris Fashion Week. Stay with us.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now, it's the last day of Paris Fashion Week, and Monocle's Takaharu Sato joins us on the line now to tell us what's been catching his eye this season. Taku, how are you, firstly, and where are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm in the Maison Revia K. Roots showroom, actually atelier, where his fashion show happened.
And what have you been seeing today? Busy day?
Very busy. One appointment one appointment every single hour. So, like, just being running around Paris.
Wow. Anything standing out to you?
Yes, literally, like, I've just finished seeing Rabia Kaywood's show. He's a Lebanese fashion designer.
Okay.
Very beautiful Greek dress motif. Beautiful, like, material. Very bright colors for autumn winter. Some of the gold cuffs were quite amazing. Very Lebanese as well. And then, yeah, just sort of really beautiful, stunning, wearable fashion show. Like, I'm very pleased to have been seeing it.
And I hear there's been some sort of ethical ones you've seen. Delvaux say they're never outsourced to China.
Yes, that's very interesting story to hear about, actually. Recently, Delvaux was bought by a Chinese company. So I was wondering whether they want to keep the manufacturing in Belgium, Europe, or they want to outsource to China. But the answer was like, no, we are not going to outsource our manufacturing to China. We keep everything in Belgium and Europe.
Is that a common, Belgium and France. Are you seeing that as a common theme now? Once people first said that, that was quite groundbreaking. And it was nice to know, and it proved popular. But if everybody does that, are everybody saying that?
Sorry, I didn't catch your question.
The idea of not going to China for the manufacturing, is that now a unique thing anymore, or are more designers jumping on that bandwagon?
For the moment, it's a bit of both, I would have to say. Mm. Because of this money situation, like some of the factories or brands have to outsource most of the manufacturing in China. But at the same time, more people are getting aware of this recognition of a made-in-China brand. Mm. So some of the brands are very sort of against this philosophy. Then apparently, Delvaux is one of those. Although like there's investment coming from China, but they are very aware of the quality. Also, lots of the wealthy customers from China, they started saying like, we don't want anything made in China. We would want to stick to the high quality that are made in Belgium, France, Italy, and so on.
And looking to Thousands of Autumn, you're a bit of a fan of that work now. Hungarian motif, embroidery that you're a big fan of, yeah?
Yes,
describe
exactly.
That.
Yes, actually, those are made in China. I'm sorry, not made in China. Made in Japan.
Okay.
Yes, made in Japan. I don't know why I keep saying that. this lady, Senshu, Miss Senshu, based in Kamakura, which is the coastline of Japan, very sort of easygoing, low-key area. Mm. I love this town. She used to live in LA, used to work for a different company. And then she started thinking, maybe I should start my own label. And then I started manufacturing everything in Japan. And then she loves like a Hungarian, Austrian traditional motifs. So she did a lot of research in the archives, and then they found really pretty motifs, embroideries. Then she started making those dresses, shoes. I found her label. And she was showing her pieces for the first time in Paris. So I was very amazed with the quality.
And a couple of interesting collaborations as well this year. Inamorato with J.M. Weston, fan of the shoes that they've created.
Yes, the designer Christian Inamorato. She used to work for a Paris label, a French label, Bonpoint, and also Cacharel. She started all her own label 5 seasons ago, and a really, really beautiful, high-quality dresses, blouses with some bows, sharp tailored suits, jackets, and skirts. She combined some of the materials that are used for her garments with J.M. Weston shoes, which are quite exclusive. Then I found those shoes very interesting, very wearable, chic.
I don't know about you, Take. I'm not sure about the idea of unisex garments. Some work, some don't. What have you seen that's come out of London, actually, in terms of unisex?
Yes. Usually when you see unisex garments, either, yes, as you said, it could be sometimes difficult. Like, if guys wear those pieces, it could be quite feminine. When women wear those pieces, sometimes like, maybe too masculine. But this label called the 1205, the designer Paola Gerbese, who used to work for Kilgar, she studied women's wear at St. Martin's in London. So she has a very deep knowledge about tailoring. But at the same time, she's very talented at designing women's clothes. So when you see the actual garments, it's very minimalistic. She uses only limited colors, such as gray, white, navy, and black. That's it.
And they would work for both genders. Take, we must leave it there. Is it all over for you? Is the fun over? Are you on your way back, or have you got anything else to do in Paris?
I have to do a couple more showroom appointments tomorrow because there are some new brands out there showing until tomorrow. And then, yeah, heading back to London tomorrow.
Well, enjoy your travels. Lovely speaking to you as always, Take. That was Takaharu Sato, Monocle's fashion editor. Now we'll stay with the French theme, I think, for this next song. This is Moi Lolita by Alizé. That was Elise and Moi Lolita. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be talking culture and cars with Monocle's editor Robert Bound in Geneva. But first, here's the news with Nick Kelly.
Thanks very much, Christian. The UN humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, has accompanied the Syrian Arab Red Crescent into the Homs district of Babar Amr. The aid convoy found that most residents of the districts had fled, though. Mitt Romney eked out a close victory in Ohio, but failed to land a knockout blow against rival Rick Santorum on the Republican presidential nominating contest's biggest night, raising the chances of a drawn-out battle between the party's establishment and its grassroots conservatives. Six British soldiers were killed when their armoured vehicle was hit by an explosion in Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, taking the British toll to 404 since the 2001 US-led invasion to oust the Taliban. Opponents of Vladimir Putin have branded his election victory an insult to the Russian people, trying to inject life into protests which risk fading after his return to the Kremlin. France has voiced scepticism that planned fresh talks between six world powers and Iran would succeed, since Tehran still did not seem sincerely willing to negotiate on the future of its controversial nuclear program. A female suicide bomber has killed at least five policemen by blowing herself up at a traffic police post in the restive Dagestan region of southern Russia. Norwegian anti-Islam militant Anders Behring Breivik was charged today with terrorism and the premeditated murder of 77 people. A trial is due to start next month. And the Mexican tycoon Carlos Slim retained his position atop Forbes magazine's annual list of the world's billionaires today, with an estimated worth of $69 billion, placing him ahead of Bill Gates at $61 billion and Warren Buffett at $44 billion. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, Nick. Now, this is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. And it's Wednesday, which means it's Culture Day here in London. Last week, we found Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, in New York. Today, he's in Geneva. Welcome, Robert.
Hi, Christian. How are you doing?
You're clocking up the air miles. Not too bad this end. Good to speak to you.
I'm clocking up the air miles, walking up the hilly, cobbly streets of the old town in Geneva, actually.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, well, exactly. I don't know whether they're air miles. They're shoe leather miles.
You're clocking up the miles on the pedometer, at least.
Exactly.
So you've been at a gallery. You are arting it up a bit. It's not all about cars in Geneva, is it? There's some art going on as well.
There is some art going on. I've actually just made it on the tram. It's terrible. What happens when there's a car show in Geneva? The irony of it is, unfortunately, is, of course, there's a billion cars on the normally quiet streets of Geneva, so I literally hopped on a tram and just made it to a new gallery called Espace Gaia to see a show by Diogo Munoz, who's a Portuguese artist. And there are a lot of Portuguese, I've noticed from doing a quick whiz around the show, there's a lot of Portuguese expats in Geneva. who are kind of high-fiving at the artist and enjoying his work. So it's a good thing. It's warm inside. It's freezing out here on the street, Christian.
Oh, you're always braving the elements, Robert.
I know, I'm a very brave reporter, aren't I, really?
Well, not once you get indoors, then you're fine. I'm just jealous.
Then I'll be fine.
Then you'll be fine. What's the work like then?
Well, it's sort of, I guess it's what you call figurative work. It's a little bit like he's not too far away from Spain, literally and artistically and figuratively. A lot of his work seems, it's mostly oil on canvas, and they're the kind of size of things that you could potentially hang over your fireplace. He's a canny man. He's not doing video installations and things like this. And they sort of appropriate things like sort of Velázquez. They look a bit Habsburgian. They look a bit Spanish, sort of royal family. So they look a little bit like Velázquez's, but they're quite witty. So there's sort of the hills of Geneva or the hills of Spain are kind of messed around in kind of vibrant colours, rainbow colours. And then there are sort of classical figures riding through this landscape. So there's a clash of modern and contemporary and sort of fine art and Renaissance art in there as well.
What's the art scene like in Geneva generally?
Well, it's a funny thing. I think people in Geneva or people that domicile here are big art buyers. Obviously, it's where the money is. It's one of the places in the world where the money is. So there's a lot of amazing collections, private collections, hanging very privately on some amazing houses that cluster around Lake Geneva. But the art scene itself is small. I mean, the gallery scene is small. So an opening like tonight, I would take you nearer to the door and give you a bit of ambient noise, but I might not be able to hear you. It's very busy. So the opportunity to nip out and get a free glass of champagne at these things is actually surprisingly rare. So little galleries like Gaia, I think, are doing well because they're answering a need for a sort of middle-class buyer. Sort of 5,000 euro.
Did you slip up there? You're in the way somewhere.
Euro buyer, you know.
Almost
got run over by a handsome
dog. Oh, you be careful. It'll be quite ironic. You're at the car shows and you got run over. Let's talk car shows briefly. What sort of themes have we seen this year? I mean, as always, small cars with the economy and the price of petrol. It's ever becoming the focus of companies to create these beautiful mini-type vehicles.
Yes, exactly. I guess there's the price of gas, which is one thing, but also there's the trend of green and the trend of hybrid, which I think is obviously it's been sort of slowly evolving over the last sort of couple of years, 3 or 4 years I've been coming to Geneva, but it feels like it's sort of finally hit its stride this year. Companies, big companies, are making cars that actually work and aren't hugely expensive to buy in the first place, and look good. You know, you don't have to be driving something that looks like a weird prototype with a very high roof and very sort of, you know, granny trolley wheels to be doing something good for the environment. And another big theme is connectivity, which I shall not use with a capital C, although some of the manufacturers would like me to, which I think is a might be a flash in the pan. I don't know. I think a lot of the manufacturers, even the very voguish, cool German high quality premium car brands, are making cars that are sort of wired up to Facebook and Twitter and being able to sort of, you know, be part of a big conversation while you're not necessarily stuck in a traffic jam but driving down a major trunk road. I don't know whether that's safe and I don't know how desirable it is either, but anyway, connectivity has certainly been one of the buzzwords at the Geneva car show this year as well.
The idea of imposing it on the windscreen as well so you can see your status updates as you're changing lanes.
I know, and exactly, and that's the thing, and I think that's a bit of a fear of mine. I don't also know whether any car I've seen this week or any car that I've seen being programmed this week is as witty as Kit from Knight Rider or as amusingly camp as Kit from Knight Rider. That's really still the gold standard for me for talking cars.
Now, I must leave it there, Robert, but stay safe. Keep out of those roads while you're on the phone to people.
I will go in and see the other half of this show. And nice speaking to you, Christian.
Enjoy the champagne, Robert. Thank you very much. That was Robert Bowne, Monocle's culture editor, joining us there. And staying with this car theme, we'll go with In Your Car by George Levin.
Sights that reveal, get la 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 la
That was In Your Car by George Levin. After this short break, we'll be talking internet piracy with the author Robert Levine and Tyler Brulé. Stay with us.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
The briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced current affairs hour at midday London time. We review the American front pages, fresh off the press, check in on the stories unfolding in Europe, and round up the events at the end of the day in Asia.
This extraordinary thing which traverses seven time zones and arrives absolutely on the minute, 8 days after you left Moscow Station.
From Buenos Aires to Boston, wake up with The Briefing, live every weekday at midday London time, 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now, for over a decade, the internet has been something of a playground for experimental business models. From music to media, paywalls to protesters, creative uses of the web have consistently outpaced legislation and regulation. After websites blacked out in protest, the US government backed down from its controversial SOPA copyright law. But last week, Ireland passed its own version. Opponents say these anti-piracy laws will spell the end of the free-for-all open nature of the internet. They claim it hands the keys of the web to the big corporations which already dominate television and print. But content doesn't grow on trees, and it seems nobody can agree where the money to pay for the internet's upkeep should come from. One man who has a few ideas is Robert Levine, the former editor of Billboard and the author of the book Free Ride: How the Internet is Destroying the Culture Business and How the Culture Business Can Fight Back. I'm also joined by Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé to get his views on the topic. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. Now, firstly, you've been quoted as saying that what we're seeing with this SOPA, it's a battle between old media and new, effectively. The internet shying away from this being over-regulated and old media wanting their content protected from pirates.
I think it's the internet shying away from being regulated at all. I mean, SOPA was a flawed bill. It was too vague. It went too far. But the response of technology companies to moderate regulation has been pretty aggressive also. They'd like that free-for-all to continue. They like having their options open. And who wouldn't?
And for a content producer, it must be difficult to strike that balance when there are so many competitors out there and a lot are offering it for free.
I think so, yeah. I mean, but I'm not, you know, as someone who, I hate saying this, makes content, I'd prefer to call myself a writer, but I'm not...
Yeah, we don't like the C word.
Fair enough.
Right?
I'm very confident in my ability. You know, if someone else is doing a version of a book on a similar topic, if someone writes about the same topic and sells their book for 99 cents or gives it away, I'm fine with that. I'm comfortable with my competitive position. What I'm not okay with is someone giving my book away for free. Mm. That's the difference.
Tyler, does the market dictate the value of work on the internet, be it a book or journalism? Should we be afraid of creating a new pricing model on the internet, or will it always fall down and will we see less money come back for the work we're putting in?
Well, I think that the media brands, people sitting around the boardroom table, need to be more confident about what they're investing in. I think that this is, I think, you know, what is central to the issue. And there's really sort of two camps with nothing between. You have the likes of really, you know, Alan Rusbridge at The Guardian, who's staked his entire reputation that, you know, everything that they do, you know, they deploy correspondents, you know, they operate, you know, quite a sizable news organization, but they want to pump everything out for free. And they're in a position, it's very hard for them to back down. There are many U.S. newspapers and media organizations which are in a similar position. But today I was in Berlin and I had lunch with Georg Maskelow, the editor-in-chief of Der Spiegel. And they're the other side. They, you know, they recognize that, you know, to go and do, let's say, their Iran cover story this week, which we've covered quite a bit, you know, that's also enormous deployment of resources, and you should not be able to go online and see that for free. You should either be buying the digital edition or you should go to the newsstand and buy that copy. But they see there's a value in it. So I think, you know, it comes down to a position of confidence on the part of the people who are the investors in running these media brands.
Robert, you've touched on in the past the way the internet grew organically and how everything's against this concept that Tyler's talking about of having content paid for fairly. Essentially, it was built on a premise that advertising would cover the cost and subscription wouldn't be needed because banner ads and audiences and pay-per-click would cover the cost. It's not. It's not delivering.
It's amazing people believe that, because when you think about it, the mentality of newspapers was always the more subscribers they had. Subscribers were all worth the same amount. Readers, I should say. The more readers you had, the more money you would make. They saw in the internet this unbounded land of opportunity, which is silly, because when you think about it, advertising, like anything else, is valued by supply and demand. The demand for advertising doesn't change that much as a percentage of GDP in developed economies. The supply, which used to be constrained, you had to print more paper, create more TV channels, is now just about limitless. So if the demand is relatively consistent and the supply is exploding, the value of advertising is going to plummet. Mm. It seems very simple.
And I think what's interesting about that is that the trinity is broken, because if you go back to traditional media, print in our case, you had, you know, the publisher, the media house ourselves, you had the reader, and then you had the advertiser. But it was a very happy relationship, because, you know, if you're the advertiser, you saw that also, yeah, the reader was also contributing to the equation because they were actively going out and buying the brand. I think that's one of the very interesting points, and maybe where we're at a turning point right now. I think a lot of media brands are, and I should say media agencies who are buying on the behalf of big brands, are not so interested in the number of clicks. They're interested in the quality now. And they're very interested in who is paying. And you know, I don't want to go into our own business model here, but that's what works very well for us. You know, people are paying, you know, $150 for a subscription to this magazine. There's no way of getting it for less. That's of enormous value right now. And I think that a lot of, you know, I think many other media players, you know, it's almost too late for them to go back and try to really shore up, you know, those types of numbers.
One example I use a lot, I like what you said about confidence. You know, Gourmet magazine it's a U.S. magazine. I'm not sure if they had it in the U.K., but it was the food magazine. Not the magazine for people who are a little interested in food, but the magazine for people who are passionate about it. Doesn't describe me. I wasn't a reader. But people who liked it loved it. They had an average, you know, a median income, household income of, I forget the exact number, but it was north of $100,000 a year. A subscription was, I think, $12. And Condé Nast closed it because they were unconfident about charging $50 a year. Now, it's a very hard economic transition to make from 12 to 50. But if you have people who are making that kind of money, who really value something, $50 is not that much. Now, no one won. You know, they didn't win by getting it cheaply. Mm. They lost because now it's not there.
It gives you a base level of income that you can then plan your editorial content on, and then advertising adds on top of that. Looking at Monocle's operation, do you see the radio service as an element of free content that almost teases the audience into a premium product? Because there's this argument of how much content do you offer for free to tease the audience in on a platform that's built on free content?
It's very much an experiment that we're in, not just with this current venture, but I think even where, you know, the web sits for media players. And you can talk to, there's no shortage of companies who have, you know, jumped in completely blind to what, you know, what the iPad is going to offer, and are now realizing that, you know, it is cumbersome. You have to design it in landscape and portrait, and it's not just about getting your designer to spend an extra hour in the office, because then you just, by, you know, by the nature of people working in art departments, you want to add more to it. But I think it goes back to the point of, you know, when you talk, Robert, about just, yeah, almost sort of the saturation point. The fact that you add a new device, you know, to the mix doesn't mean that suddenly there's going to be an upsurge, you know, in ad pages or necessarily readers who want to go there. I think you have to do something very distinct and different, which is why we said, let's have a magazine but let's have, of course, the same editorial philosophy, but let's deliver this as an audio service, and let's try to figure out a way where you can still make it sound like public service, but do it with a very light but very focused advertising offer. You know, and I can say almost 6 months, so far so good. We're all here anyway.
Yes, and long may it continue.
And I think there's also a sense of seeing what works. I mean, in the magazine business, traditionally, promotion was an expense. Mm. You paid to get those subscribers to, you know, by direct mail, by advertisements, however, by billboards, however you did it, varies in different countries. If you can give away some content, that's a better, more effective means of promotion because you're using stuff you have already instead of paying cash. That's great. The problem is you have to set that barrier. You know, if you write a crime story, you give the whole thing away for free and then you charge for the last chapter, whodunit, that could be a great business model, as long as you can charge for that last chapter.
Just bringing it back to SOPA and similar legislation around the world that's being proposed, will it not benefit bigger companies more so, giving them the chance to impose more restrictions on their content? And at the same time, smaller outlets will find their freedoms cut to serve that legislation.
You're the expert on that
It
one.
Shouldn't. I mean, SOPA might. What SOPA would do depends on a lot on your interpretation of SOPA. And that was a very. There were a lot of things in that law that were extremely vague. But I think that copyright does not inherently benefit big companies. Big companies have been more successful at litigating because they're big. Mm. But that, you know, any lawsuit favors the player who hires the best lawyers. That's not inherent to copyright law. That's in any feature of the legal system. Now, in the U.S., you have fair use, which means more things are decided by the court. That means it's in favor of bigger companies. But bigger companies isn't only record companies and movie companies. Mm. It's also Google. So what's Google doing in the U.K.? They want fair use. I would argue that's because it doesn't favor old or new, it favors big against small. And that's something we should be watching out for. But I think the advantage is to bigness more than anything else.
We've run out of time. Robert Levine, thank you ever so much for that. And also Tyler Brulé, thank you for your thoughts. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 Tag, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokossa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I'm into Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Time now to head to New York, where the Armory Show is underway. It's a leading international contemporary and modern art fair, one of the most important annual art events in the city. It opens to the public tomorrow, but today's been the preview day, where the business happens. And I'm joined by the art advisor, Lisa Schiff, who's at the show right now. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi.
Now, firstly, how many big sales have happened? This is, as we said, where the big business happens today. What big deals have been struck?
I have to say, I haven't done any sales today, but I'm not trying to at this fair right now.
What are you there for, then?
Oh, I'm here looking at art, and I did buy something last night at the ADAA fair, which also opened, and there's another fair that's opening at tomorrow called the Independent, and I'm sure there are some big sales happening here. There are some beautiful booths. Ruth Mogger's looks amazing. Listen looks amazing. But I don't know that, and definitely people are buying. It's a very positive energy here.
Now, the Armory Show's tipping itself as the hottest ticket now in New York, but the ADAA, you're quite a fan of that as well.
I think the ADAA is probably the strongest of fairs.
What did you see there? What did you see there today?
Last night it opened. I had the preview last night. Last night, Sean Regan from Los Angeles had a booth full of Elliot Hunley works, the young artists from L.A. that were fantastic. Anton Kern had a booth of Matthew Monahan that also looked amazing. Barbara Gladstone and Tony Meyer had a shared booth of another L.A. artist named Dave Muller. It's a very elegant fair. It's very small. It's very manageable.
Okay.
And the Armory, there's good energy here. There's just a little... maybe it's like a confused year just in the sense of there's a new fair opening in New York in May, and it's Freeze New York. The art fair that's held in London will be also start being held in New York. So there's sort of some limbo in the air as to which one will really become the dominant fair.
Looking at the Armory show and some of the work we see in it, is it representative of what's going on in the world? Is it the pinnacle now of the global art scene?
No, not at all.
I've seen a couple of ones that struck me as quite interesting. Have you seen the palm tree there? That's in the center of the room, quite tall.
Oh, well, I'm sitting in the VIP room right now. So no, I have not seen that. I'm sure I walked past it. But no, the Armory is it's a very busy event right now. All the collectors are here. In terms of the pinnacle of the art world as an art fair, I don't think this is the main fair. In terms of New York City and everything happening here, yes, it's definitely, I would say, at the forefront of the art world.
Why do you think it's scaled down from previous years? It's a bit smaller this time around, isn't it?
Exactly what I just explained. It's sort of been in question for the last few years as to whether or not it will actually survive. The people who run the Armory are fantastic. They're amazing, and they really worked hard this year to revamp it, and I think they've done an incredible job. And, you know, there's a lot of art fairs in the world, and a lot of them are bigger than this fair. I think part of it is New York City is an art fair 24/7. It's always happening. There are always amazing shows here. A lot of New York galleries don't even do the art fair because they just go to their gallery if you would like to. But it's not that we don't need it or that it's not helpful or functional. It's fantastic. It's just for some reason it's been in limbo for the past couple of years, or you know, it doesn't feel like it's for sure which way it's going to go.
And just lastly, Nordic art's proving quite popular at this show this time around. Is that right?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Nordic art getting a lot of popularity now.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That is kind of amazing, and I think was a really brilliant idea. There are some amazing Scandinavian artists. There are some very cool performances that are happening around the Armory, which I think are fantastic. There's one tomorrow night at the Ace Hotel with a collaborative called Moonspoon Saloon from Copenhagen, which is made up of Dutch artists Tal R, Sarah, and I'm forgetting her last name.
Lisa, I'm so sorry. We've run out of time. Lisa, I'm ever so sorry. We've run out of time today. That was Lisa Schiff, art analyst. We are out of time for this Monday edition. The show was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. In 3 hours' time, it's time for the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time. Thanks for your company.